Welcome to the Roy Harper podcast. This is episode number 12 for mid-August 2008. This is the special sort of mid-August bonus episode that includes part two of our epic three-part interview with Roy Harper. So, in this show, the interview itself, the A to Z of Harper, this time the letter M, some listener feedback, a bit weird this time, but I think you'll like it, and some music. Now, as you may hear from my voice, I'm not very well. I managed to come back from the Cropperty Festival at the weekend with bronchitis. I've been to the doctor and I'm on antibiotics, so I won't be doing too much talking during this podcast, which for some of you may be a good thing. So just to recap, if you haven't heard part one of Roy Harper's interview, I'd suggest you stop this podcast immediately and go and download episode 12 and listen to that first. I spent some time in Ireland with Roy and we got 2 hours and 40 minutes worth of interview. In this episode, we're running 50 minutes or so, and in the third part, which will be out on September the 1st, I'll be running The Remains, which will be about an hour and 10 minutes, so the next podcast will be mainly interview. We're sort of ramping up to it, really, but I divided it up into the sensible stopping points. Once all three parts of the interview are out, I'm going to make a download of just the interview in one big long chunk available from the website, so that those of you that want to have it for archives and so on can get it without all of the podcast surroundings that we normally have. Now, at the time of recording this, I've just had a quick look at my download stats and I've had just over a thousand listens to the last podcast, which is really great. So thank you all very, very much for letting me break my record. It's about 800 downloads of the MP3 file and a couple of hundred plays directly from the website. For those of you who don't know, by far the best way of listening to podcasts is to download an MP3. And there's a download audio file link on the website, which gives you a file which you can play in Windows Media Player or iTunes or other things. Much better than playing it directly from the website, because if you navigate away from the page, of course the podcast will stop, and it's very easy to do that by accident. The better way of keeping up with podcasts once you've found one you like is to use what we call a podcatcher, which will let you subscribe to a podcast, and I've put a subscription link on stormcock.net so that you can have a go at that. If you've got an iPod, or if you just use iTunes as your music playback program on your PC or Mac, then it deals with these things automatically. But there are a load of other applications that can also do the same thing. And what happens is that when I bring out a new podcast, I update what's called a feed, and your software will look at this feed from time to time and say, aha, there's a new podcast episode, I'll go and grab it for you. And then next time you go into the application, you'll see it there, so you don't have to do anything. Much better than manually going to a website every few days to see if there's a new episode. Anyway, that's enough of that for now. In the background, I'm playing Miles Remains, which is from Roy's wonderful Death or Glory album. I'm going to fade that out and go straight into the interview. Managers, and we've kind of touched on that anyway, because you talked about the way that the whole record company stuff went. In the sort of 70s, you had Peter Jenner doing a lot of stuff, and he seemed to be really pushing and promoting your cause, so to speak.
Well, Pete was brilliant as a manager for me.
Yeah.
We both were, in some ways, in many ways, peas from the same pod.
Right.
We were both, you know, philosophical. We could both talk about stuff for hours that had nothing to do with records. You know, absolutely nothing to do with anything at all, except, you know, just wind. And, you know, we smoked a lot of joints and had our feet up on the mixer.
Mm.
And we just let loose, and it was a pretty good relationship. I really enjoyed it. A lot of the time it wasn't being as productive as it could have been, but I don't, you know, I don't really think that that's that true either, because we produced some really good things. And I think Pete was a catalyst for me.
Right.
I think he was He was the fixer. Pete was the fixer. He fixed it with EMI.
Yeah.
You know, he kind of said, no, he's still all right. He's going, he's doing things. He's, you know, we're working. Roy will always be Roy. And we will have to, you will have to understand that.
So he acted as a kind of sanity buffer then, maybe.
Well, when EMI were at their... When EMI and I were at our worst loggerheads, Pete would be there to referee. But, in fact, he was not that pleased with EMI's... Well, he wasn't pleased with EMI's input at all. But he was more of a referee than I was. I mean, to be honest, I treated the business with disdain.
Yeah.
And so I deserve what I've got, you know.
What, just by not playing in the rules?
Yeah, I didn't lick anybody's boots at all, you know. Why? Why would you?
Well, quite. Why would or should you?
Why would you?
But a lot of people did.
A lot of people did, yeah. There was a sort of, you know, various teams of people, you know, going around and doing various things, and you heard about it, you saw it, you know. There were people in each other's pockets for some reason or another. And there was always the, you know, the sexual thing, whether it was heterosexual or homosexual, and the homosexual thing governed the music business for a while as well, which was, you know, something that was happening over in another corner.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
you know, but you know, it was a very strange kind of being involved in all of that, and I needed a referee. You know, I wasn't actually interested in it at all. You know, you realise that, you know, somebody would come around the studio, you know, one of the big bosses at EMI, and, you know, you'd shake their hands and they'd say, well, that sounds quite nice what you're doing there. And I'd say, yeah, so I've been doing it quite a while now. Oh, how long have you been recording with us? Oh, about 8 years now. Oh, I must have a look at your breakdown.
You know, yeah, yeah, that says it all, really.
It says it all. Must go and have a look at your figures.
I mean, I suppose in the latter years, a manager was more of a road manager. Or?
Well, as I should have said, come in, Lovey. Come in, Lovey. Please, well, welcome.
Well, there you
here,
go.
Have some toast.
That was, yeah, a crucial turning point.
Crucial, really crucial. I was nowhere near, you know, androgynous enough. Sorry, androgynous. Androgynous would be something else, wouldn't it? I was just thinking about deep space there.
So, in the latter years, I mean, with the own record company, I guess you don't need a manager as such, because you don't need to represent yourself to yourself, so to speak, but you need a road manager if you are...
Yeah, that's right.
Doing that stuff.
All you need is the basics, the real basics, because you realise that what most of that was in the 70s was bullshit, in any case. It was bullshit between people, where what was happening was that the young people communicated among themselves, and you were all of the same age. The A&R man was your age.
Right.
You know, the publicist was your age, the plugger was your age. They were into you. Or they weren't.
Yeah.
You know. And if they weren't, you got the plugger who was into you.
Yeah.
You know, who could go around the shops and say, have you heard this? We're selling thousands of it. Oh, look, you know, it's the best thing since, you know, the cat. And, you know, you get things sold because you were in that inner generation of young people.
Mm.
But once you moved out of that generation, it got a lot harder.
Mm. Mm.
You know, seriously difficult, because the young people were not going to work for someone who, A, was not going to be it, you know, it's not going to be the this week's fashion. And money was running out, so less people were being paid for the jobs that used to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And it was generally, there was generally a downturn that they didn't suspect at the time. Of course, your big stars, the ones who were just earning a little more than me, or not, they were actually earning a lot more, but they didn't have any more kudos at the time than me. They didn't have any more, you know, celebrity, if you like, to coin a modern word. They managed to stay in there because their balance sheets were, you couldn't refuse.
Yes,
Mick Jagger.
I see. Yes.
You couldn't refuse, you know, Elton John. You couldn't refuse The Who. None of those people could be refused. They would command a new balance sheet somewhere else, you know, whereas people like me just naturally fell by the wayside, because although we had followers, and although we have people who intensely believed in us, those people didn't have enough money.
So there was like a critical mass effect, I suppose.
Yeah.
You know, you either went into a self-sustaining thing or not.
Don't yeah. know. And, well, they were both self-sustaining.
Mm.
The both sides, you know. You could either afford to maintain the same team that you'd had during the 70s, during the boom period, or you couldn't. And that was the dividing line between people.
Right.
We could, perhaps, if I'd have got the band trigger that I had in the mid-70s, kept them together, and you know, and gone through a couple of years of abject poverty with them, which they probably wouldn't have done, but who knows? Who knows? We might have been able to scrape through with Trigger.
That was a really good HQ. I mean, it's just
We may have been able
to criticise that album. It's a very very.
We may have
time.
Just been able at the last moment to get onto that step, which
right.
enabled me, which would have enabled me to carry on in the way that I was carrying on. But
right.
see, since then, since the advent of the 80s, I've been, the beginning of the 80s was shocking. I went from having everything to having nothing. So it was a very, very difficult period altogether.
Mm.
And I can remember people writing to me in that age, you know, saying, "Hi, how are you doing, blah, blah, you know, is there anything we can do for you in the current nadir of your career, you know?" And you knew they were well-intentioned friends with, you know, their own lives, their own careers, and you couldn't really say, "Well, I need this, I need that,
yeah.
I need that, I need," you know, because everybody knew what you needed.
Yeah.
Whether you got it or not is, you know, whether you got it or not is how healthy your balance sheet had been just at the crisis point of where the punks hit in 77, probably.
Yeah, somewhere around there. Yeah.
77 was the crucial year.
Yeah.
So that the music business suddenly, really suddenly, right at that year, right on that year, got A, younger, and B,
yeah.
older.
Yes.
And so I floundered. I managed to make one more record in Unknown Soldier, but even Pete and I fell out on Unknown Soldier because I was doing things. He was in America with The Clash.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, he also was touring Britain with Ian Dury. And, you know, and the moment he got Billy Bragg involved, I was number four on the list. And, you know, that was a very difficult...
That can't have been easy.
That was very difficult. That was the end.
Yeah.
That spelt the end. So it was a very, very difficult period for me. And the beginning of the 80s, of course, was I was penniless, virtually penniless, because I'd put, stupidly but well-intentioned, I'd put what cash I had, which was all in the one house, into trying to maintain myself on the old level.
Yeah.
But, you know, I should never have done that. I should never have risked that house.
It's much easier to say that in hindsight, though, isn't it?
Much easier, but I should never have done it.
Yeah.
There were people who were dishonest around me at that point, and who were willing just to take that cash.
Right.
And one of them did. And so I lost that house in Hereford to Barclays Bank Hayes. And so in 1980, I think it was, around about 1980, I was the first of a long line of people losing their houses.
Yeah, well, there was a lot of it going on.
A lot of it.
Yeah.
And I was among the first people that was going to happen to. But strangely enough, after that, you know, I got a mortgage. We got a mortgage with my then partner, Verna. And I got a mortgage for about 40,000 for a house in Clapham. We came out of the old house in Hereford, which now has sold for, I don't know, something, a couple of million.
Was that the farm? The Vauld farm, was it, or something?
Yeah, okay.
I saw the estate agent's thing.
If I could have bought it, if I could have moved back there, I would have done.
Yeah.
But we came out of it with £2,000 and a car. And that's what it was in. That was 1980.
Yeah.
And there was nothing. So we got a mortgage, and we were broke, and, you know. And that was it. We didn't actually last much longer than that together. I think it affected us.
Oh, I can imagine.
Affected us really badly, because we lost our life, really.
Yeah.
And I needed a new life as well. There were various things happening in the relationship that, you know, weren't conducive to carrying on anything like the old life. And so I gradually got into how I was going to conduct affairs over the next passage of time. And it was very messy. The 80s was incredibly messy. It wasn't helped at all by the things that Margaret Thatcher was doing. But, you know, what happened to me in the 80s is that I got a different following than I'd got in the 70s, purely because of the stand that some of the stands that I was taking in the 80s with regard to disarmament and, you know, people being put out of work.
Yes.
And those benefit gigs that all of us did, you know, for things like, well, the anti-nuclear ones were important at the time. And I realise now that nuclear is going to be a component of the future, because it's almost got to be. But it actually, you would like to think that at this time in history they've got that into a cleaner condition than it was in those days. Because all we used to see in those days was things that were going to definitely lead up to Chernobyl, which they did.
Yes.
You know, and I think the lesson of Chernobyl has been taken to heart by a lot of people now. We're not, and I wouldn't say that I'm anti-nuclear energy anymore. I would have to say that in order to maintain anything like we've experienced in the past years since the Second World War, then we're going to have alternative sources of energy that involve nuclear energy.
I think that's very clear, but the thing that frightens me is this whole putting things out to tender and accepting the lowest price for things. And when I'm in an aircraft and I know that Boeing have, you know, used the cheapest contractor to make the fuselage or whatever, it doesn't inspire confidence. And I don't know what the answer is to that, but I worry that if we are going to be building lots more nuclear facilities, it's going to end
but
up...
But it has the testing has to go through the, what is it, IAFA?
Yeah.
IAAF?
I forget what the acronym
IAAF
is.
IAAF or yes. something, isn't it?
WWF.
And the testing has to go through, you know, that airworthiness authority, doesn't it?
Yes, it does.
So that you would think that in the end, although cheaper components were used, they weren't so cheap that they were going to be... In other words, the lifetime, the guaranteed lifetime is what we're going to be able to have to look at.
No, that's fair. I think I'm just very cynical.
I know, and so am I. It's not a cynicism that's actually that you can avoid.
Mm.
You can't avoid it because you know the way that people are.
Yeah.
You know that people are going to cut corners, whatever, and for financial reasons. So, you know, it's the one branch of... I don't like the word cynicism. Mm. I don't like it. But when it comes to it, I think that we're all slightly cynical when it comes to that, all of us consumers, on the end of being, you know... ripped off.
The problem with being cynical is that sometimes you get taken over by it, and therefore somebody that comes up to you with the best of intentions, you treat in a suspicious way. And I've found in the past I've done that to people and then realised that they were genuinely idealistically open to stuff. And by being bombarded by crap, sometimes we close our minds to new opportunities.
Yeah.
You know. And I get annoyed about that as well.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I just to actually round that off, the whole of what we're talking about just there. I can remember flying from Seattle from San Francisco to Seattle. In, I think it was 1993. I can remember it because Robin Hitchcock was on the same flight as me.
Oh right, yeah.
And we spoke to one another, and it was the first time I'd met him. And we'd both been to San Francisco to do something. We were going to San Francisco. It was the same jaunt. It was a festival or something. I think it was a festival in Seattle, perhaps. It was called something Boom, I think. Oh no, that was maybe later. But anyway, we got on this flight, and there was some confusion about the bags.
Mm.
And I said, "Well, I need my bags with me." And this woman, she was kind of an air hostess. She came to me. I was paged, and we met. And she said, "Your bags at the moment are lost, but we'll find them. We'll put them on the next flight." And I said to her, "This is 93.
Yeah,
this is 93." I said to her, "You realize that what you're doing there is really dangerous." And she said, and she blew it off. She sort of blew it off. And I said, "Look, it's really, really dangerous. What you're doing is dangerous. There can be a bomb in that." And she didn't take me seriously at all. She didn't take me seriously. Not one. And Tracy will tell you about it because she was, you know, she was with me.
Mm.
And it was a kind of a... it was the kind of cynical treatment that I got from her that you would expect from authority in that position.
Yes.
And, you know, it was only like 8 years, 7 or 8 years after that actually Well, when was the bag put in the bomb in Munich? When was Lockerbie?
That was a long time ago now, actually. It was around there, wasn't it?
It was around
there,
yeah.
I think
it was. Hmm. So it was Lockerbie, and I knew full well of what the dangers were, because, you know, it was obvious what the dangers were. Mm. But this woman I was talking to just did not have a clue. Mm. And I realised that the Americans were just not... They weren't... It was that insular component in there. They just weren't willing to think that anything like that could ever happen.
No, I mean, that was very clear when the Twin Towers went as well, because suddenly it was real and it was on
their doorstep.
It was a real wake-up call, that. It had been very sort of innocent before then.
Yeah. There was an innocence together with a corporate cynicism.
Yes. Yeah.
And, you know, the poor Americans, they were innocent then. You know, I can remember going out to California in the 1970 and just being in awe about how innocent people really were. You know, I mean, there was a lot of course, in terms of writers in California, you'd had people like Henry Miller and William Burroughs, but who were men of the world who were actually wrote books which were anything but innocent. You know, The Naked Lunch is not innocent.
Yeah.
But generally, the people on the ground. You know,
yes.
The people on the ground. There was a sort of widespread innocence, and that's one of the reasons that the whole explosion in the 60s, which was, you know, Vietnam generated in many ways.
Oh, yeah.
But the explosion of those times that people had with each other was really innocent, and up until 1980, right through a lot of the 70s, there was a lot of innocence in America.
Mm. Personally, one of the best things that I get from your music are the longer, more complicated pieces. McGoohan's Blues, The Lord's Prayer, One of Those Days in England, Burn the World, and I guess, you know, the long songs on Stormcock even, and I get a lot of enjoyment out of longer, complicated compositions. And I suppose the question is, I mean, what is it that makes you decide to compose a longer song? Is it to do with having more to say that won't fit into your 3-minute
Well, sometimes, yeah, but I'm addicted to the epic.
Yes.
And I think that, you know, in my younger life, I liked Endymion, Keats's Endymion, for its length, just for its sheer length. And that, you know, there are other poets, of course, who have, and of course Endymion is, I've written about and written a song which involves Endymion just recently. It's actually a short song. But, suddenly occurs to me why Endymion would suddenly spring to my mind. But that was a poem that was very influential in my life, because I read it when I was 12, and, you know, well, actually I was probably younger than that. I was 11, wasn't I? I was 11, so I read it when I was 11, and it had a big influence on what I did. And I think actually that it's a poem as well written by a young man, which would have appealed to a boy, because it's got a lot of, perhaps it's not as mature as Keats got.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's an immature poem in many ways, but, and that's maybe why it can be accepted by, you know, someone as young as I was.
Because there is a certain resonance there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I Of course, I didn't know that at the time. I mean, I know that now, but, you know, looking back in hindsight, that's a possible reason for my, you know, love of the piece. But there are other people as well. I didn't particularly like Byron. I thought that he, you know, he waffled on a bit. You know, and it was, you know, Childe Harold and those things, which were quite long. But they were quite good, quite good. And, of course, you know, Byron in his life was, and you know, fairly heroic in some ways. You know, he died for a cause and all of that sort of stuff. But there are other examples, you know. I think Oscar Wilde's The Ballad of Reading Gaol is, when you take it in the context of, particularly when you take it in the context of what he was going through and what they were putting him through, then I think it's one of those moments where you have to stand back and think properly about the world you belong to. But I think as a long poem, it works for me. It works in those ways. So I was addicted to the epic for, you know, a long time before I started writing songs. And in fact, at the, I've got a poem that I wrote, and it's called The Whim, The Whisper and The Wilderness. And I wrote it when I was 15, and it's a long poem. And somebody, about 10 years ago, 12 years ago, turned up and said, "Oh, I've got that poem of yours." And, I said, "Oh, you must give me your address." And I think he did give me an address, and I've lost it, of course. So the poem still exists. You know, it still exists, and that's... that's an amazing thing. So, you know, you've got something that's written very, very early by me that's very long.
That's intriguing.
It is.
I have to keep watching eBay.
Yeah. It'll probably be there sooner or later. It's all handwritten. It'll be all handwritten because, you know, there was no typewriter in my life then. There was no QWERTY board of any kind.
Yeah.
But anyway, that's the genesis of the long thing. It's not got much to do with anything else, really.
For what you're saying, though, it is more to do with the lyrical content rather than the musical structure. Because some of the musical structures of the long songs also I like, because it's kind of moving from one theme to another, and it's a kind of flow and bringing you to different places emotionally through both the music and the
words. Beauty of music, that's what music can do, and that's what I soon realised when I, you know, not only in playing songs, but as soon as I started to write them, you realise that you could take something into a different direction. You could... it was a vehicle that you could move, you could drive away in. And a big, very, very useful vehicle too. You could alter your mood at will. And, you know, it's such a fantastic tool, music. And, you know, I embraced it for all it was worth. And I've used it. I've used those nuances in mood and feel and things just to, you know, enhance the words.
I mean, one of your classic long songs is One of Those Days in England, and a lot of people talk about that as being so very sort of English at its core, a kind of, you know, encapsulation of what it means to be a an Englishman or whatever. And you're an example of...
I think that's Keats. And
that's where
Shelley.
It comes from. So that's the kind
Keats
of...
Keats and Shelley, I think that's where that's from.
Yeah.
I you know, with the long songs, I've always been inspired by having the space in which to dream. And that's important. They're all dreams in some way. And you give yourself space to do that. I mean, you can have a two-second dream, and obviously, you know, you do every night. Dreams are often very short, and, you know, time isn't how any of us understand it to be. You know, something that's 2 seconds can... Something that lasts for 2 seconds can affect you for a lifetime. And, you know, so... You have to be careful with time, with mentioning, you know, time as a quality. It can't always be nailed down. In fact, it can't be nailed down a lot of the time.
Well, yeah, and perceived time is a flexible thing.
Yeah, perception. I don't want to go any further down that road because that's just going to get me into a place where we've just run through half an hour of tape and, you know, goodbye.
Well, we're okay because we're not using tape. But yes.
I am using tape.
You, yeah, I know you are. No, I'm just.
No. You know, I don't want to constrain you with that. That's something I don't want to do.
Okay. Another question, and this is kind of not a particularly deep question, but you've got some songs in your oeuvre which people would say are kind of sillier songs, kind of light-hearted songs. The Methane Zone is a good example. That was the single when you did Death or Glory, and there's the last track of Jugular, which, you know, isn't always easier to listen to at the end.
No, it's brilliant.
And well, there you go. But also, I mean, more recently, you were performing the song Pan in a live context, and it sparked off a bit of a furore in a way, because people were saying, oh, this is really puerile. So I suppose the question is, do you put them in as light relief, or do they contain their own sort of weighty
matter?
I don't
think that's puerile at all, that song. That is purely... That's exactly where the human is at. Or human sexual behaviour, anyway. It relates to all that kind of stuff. What I think you've got to understand is that when I think that I've been in any way preaching or, you know, proselytizing in any way at all, then I have a recoil mechanism which kicks in, and it's kind of I try to disown what I've said. I try to disarm it, at least.
Yes,
because, you know, being serious all the time, and a lot of my stuff is based on a serious thought, or something I perceive to be a serious thought. But you can only do so much of that because it's very tiring for people. And it's also, you know, I suffered from that when I was younger. I suffered from being preached at, and I do have that as a, you know, as part of the motivation for me doing what I do in any case, and I don't want to pass that on to an audience. I just don't want to pass it on. It was vulgar to be preached at, and it was repulsive, and I don't want to do that. So, you know, the way it manifests itself, really, that is a moment of tomfoolery, you know, where I do something silly on a stage. And where, you know, I used to pull faces. I don't think I've got any need anymore. You know. But, you know, I've always responded to the natural rather than to the cultural. Because, you know, insofar as the cultural is something that humans have built, it's a building. It's actually the largest, it's the biggest edifice we've got. is huge. But I've always wanted to respond to the... I've needed to respond to the... that's the phone. Go away. I've always wanted to respond to the unmanufactured.
Right.
You know, the un... culture. No, I'm not anti-culture, not at all. You know, yeah. You know... there is a responsibility to respond to the natural, and even though, you know, there's someone idiot at the back of the room who's intent on responding to you with his arse, you know. But I've engendered that with what I've done, you know, with what I've done, with how I've done it over the years, with having that mechanism there. That's what it has engendered.
I had a conversation with... You've just reminded me, actually. I had a conversation with Nick a few years ago, and I was talking to him about the fact that his gigs had these incredibly serious moments and then complete light relief. And it kind of acted as a punctuation. And it's almost like... I'm talking crap now, but it's like a teaching technique where you drive home the main message for a little while, and then you do something to sort of ease off for a moment. That's right. And that is more effective than just, as you would say, preaching on endlessly with an important message, because people will actually...
It is. It's very tiring to be preached at.
Yeah.
And, you know, I can't do it. And, you know, I'm very pro-culture, as I say, you know, and it's the biggest of all the human buildings that we've managed to build. It's a massive achievement, and it is at any one moment. You know, at any one moment, it is the sum of what we are. You understand? I mean, the culture is it. We are our culture.
Mm.
And at any given moment on the planet, that's what's going on. But, of course, and, you know, all creatures on the planet, to a greater or lesser degree, can be said to be to have a culture, but ours is the... we have a history of our culture, and it's a deep and profound history of a huge space of time, you know. But we have this history, and it's a history really of our consciousness, and it's a very deep thing. I mean, it's, you know, there isn't anything more valuable than culture.
Mm.
But, and this is the point, human culture is all about the evolution of interpretation. And full stop. That's it. You can't... That is the point. And my own interpretation, of course, my own interpretations of culture, they're minuscule. They don't count. Nobody does, of course. You know, there are very few people who can be said to have personally inputted into human culture to enable it to move into... predominantly into one direction, mm-hmm. by their own simple...
Okay, yeah.
You know, I mean, you've got luminaries like Gandhi in the last century and, you know, Christ a couple of thousand years ago, but that's debatable. I mean, you know, moving it in directions like that. And it's... but, you know, it doesn't... it's... I've become what I am on a stage because... that's what I am. That is me. That's the natural.
Well, that's why I think people respond to the live setting so well, normally so well, I think, because they realise that's what they're getting. They're not getting a polished sort of veneer, are they?
If I was to think, or if I was to have behaved in any different way, I don't think I'd have got to the place where I write from.
Yeah.
At all. I wouldn't have done it. So it's a matter of understanding yourself, I guess. But, you know. And, you know, I've always been inspired by those long songs that give me the space as well. I think I hit the nail on the head there. You know, the human culture is all about the evolution of interpretation. And we all do it. And we're all, you know, anybody who's ever written or and we all put it in. Of course, mine's a little or. And it's not a building. It's not a huge edifice built brick by brick and stands there forever. It's not like that. It's like it's a fluid ocean. It's a huge ocean, human culture.
Mm.
A huge ocean. It's indescribable, inconceivable how big it is. It actually is. And all the various branches of it. But it is a whole culture. And it actually, it doesn't belong to anyone. And it doesn't belong to any group either. And it never will. Mm. It can't. It's too fluid. The moment you try to say, this is what I'm going to do with it, is the moment that the liquid, the fluid seeps out under the door and through the windows.
Yeah.
And, you know, so the thousand-year Reich becomes an impossibility. And that's where we are as humans. That's what, you know, we are dependent on this culture that we have. Completely dependent on it to a large degree. Without it, we'd be feral again. Which, you know, may even happen. But I can't forget that it's not forgettable for me that the culture that I enjoy and the whole of human culture that I do enjoy, and I do enjoy, you know, 90% of it, is apart from the natural feral Roy that's out there on a stage. Who's out there on a stage? Not that. I'm not of that. I'm a who. You know, the natural feral Roy who is out there on a stage behaves the way an animal will, without that cultural overlay.
Mm.
You know, of course, there is culture in it. It's you know, it's bound with culture. It's, you know, it stinks of culture. But actually, I like the animal in there.
Mm.
I want to see the animal in there. I want to see it. I want to be that animal in there. That's, you know, that's part and parcel of what I do for me.
Yeah.
I am the animal. And I will be the animal. So shut up.
Well, talking of animals, I wanted to talk to you a bit about fringe elements in your audience. I mean, this is a slightly tongue-in-cheek question, I suppose, but, you know, over the years I've noticed that you attract a certain type of...
Well, that's the reason.
...person, and that's why, isn't it?
It's the reason.
Yeah.
That's the reason. You've given what you do is you let yourself down badly in one way, because, you know, you're going into a gig knowing that it's going to be disruptive.
Yes.
That it's going to be, you know, disrupted.
But I like that sort of element of danger, unpredictability.
But it actually, it's an element of lunacy.
Mm.
You know, it's not so unpredictable. That, you know, what is predictable is the unpredictability. But that's not, you know, that's kind of... and sometimes, you know, you can sink or swim. And, you know, and sometimes it's loopy. And sometimes you get a good time out of it. And everybody has a good time, everybody has a good laugh. And you manage to pull things off that you want to pull off. But it does attract that kind of person, because those kind of people that want to be part of that exhibition of themselves.
Yes, you know. That's right.
Because what I am is an animal, and I exhibit the animal.
And you can tell that people get so sort of caught up in it all that it it is like having, for them, it's a conversation and it's an event and it's something they feel that they can themselves into, and they do.
Actually, I'm tired of it. Mm. I'm really tired of it. I'm tired of gigging altogether because, you know, and that's one of the reasons. But, you know, it's a rod I've made for my own back.
Mm.
But, you know, I think I'm tired of gigging because I should be getting more out of it than I'm getting at the moment.
Right.
You know, it seems to me to be... I've reached the end of the cul-de-sac. And, you know, it'd be okay if it was... You know, if I'd treated it in the same way as, say, Billy Connolly. And, you know, I'd gone into comedy rather than into trying to actually give you the poem on wheels.
Yes, yes.
If I'd gone into comedy and stayed in comedy, it'd be totally different. Mm-hmm. And I'd be different than Billy and Jasper Carrot and, you know, all the people who did that. The people who were on the folk scene.
Right, and then
who went off into comedy, right?
Yeah.
And I'd be another one and a different one of those. I'd be probably more like, you know, Richard Pryor, but, you know, it's not what I wanted to do. I didn't want to do that. I still needed to, the songs were important. The poem was the most important thing in my life. The nuance of poetry, the nuances of poetry, you know, the things that you can slip in between two words. There's the sound in between two words.
Mm.
You know, the knowledge that's there in between just two words. Pick any two words. Carpe diem. And there's a noise between the two of them. Mm. You know.
So that's it for part two of the interview. Part three will be in just 2 weeks' time. Part three covers some of the burning questions about what happens next with reissues, new material, gigs and everything else. Now, a quick track here. I'm going to play something off of Poems, Speeches, Thoughts and Doodles. This is a CD of poetry and short snippets that Roy did a few years ago. And it's been out of print for quite a long time. And it's quite weird, but I found that it goes for a very high price on auction. One of them came up on eBay recently and sold for £150, which means that there's a huge demand out there for this rare CD. And that prompted me to play a track off of it just for fun. This is called Your Tongue in Their Cheeks.
Don't wanna sit on a toadstool talking pixie and dodging the bath. Against the wind with the same old mellow yellow slashing right out of my mouth. Don't want establishment cozy, don't have a smug little dream. Swapping smiles and congratulations with the cream of the cream. Walking on air, somewhere up there, hardly aware. Walking on air. Don't wanna look over my shoulder and copy what Jonesy has done. When he's gonna die of mildew on the dumper while trying to postpone. Walking on air, somewhere up there, hardly aware. Walking on air. I don't want a weak-hearted woman, a formula off the pack spare. I'm in love with living and danger and keeping me there. Walking on air, somewhere out there, being aware, always.
Time for the A to Z of Harper now. This was a very easy choice for the letter M. As I've mentioned before, I really like the longer and more epic songs, and Roy has two in the canon, Magooan's Blues and Me and My Woman, which I both love to bits. Now, Magooan's Blues is on the Folk Joker Opus album, and it's a kind of tribute to Patrick Magooan, who famously starred in the Prisoner TV series. This is a very thought-provoking serial about an individual's role, how somebody remains an individual in a surveillance society, and how he combats all of the pressures, both external and internal, to conform and to think in certain ways. This was initially filmed in the late 60s, and it's never been more appropriate now into today's surveillance society and sheep-like behaviour. Wonderful track, takes up an entire side of an album, so I'm not going to play it in this podcast because I simply don't really have time. But Me and My Woman is one of the four long songs on the wonderful Stormcock album. And again, it's about a commentary on one's role in life, but it's more of a life-aware track. It's about how you fit into things, how you what your outlook is, how you enjoy life, and how you deal with the challenges that come. And it's a much more pastoral number than Magooan's Blues. And what I've decided to do is pick a version of it that was recorded at the Royal Festival Hall during Roy's 60th birthday celebrations. This included Roy on stage, but also David Bedford with a full strings orchestra backing him. And this is a wonderful version of what I think is one of the most high points in Roy's output, Me and My Woman.
Place in the scheme. It's a question, really. Me and my woman. Where to? A brief history, or something lasting. I never know what time of day. My battlefield of ideas, but the way she touches and the way it feels must be just how it heals. Ah, but it's got a little better since I let her know what time of year it is, sitting on top of the fire, but the robin outside has to hunt and hide the cold frosty shire. Ah, but he knows just what goes between his cold toes and his warm ears, and he's got no disguise in his eyes for as love as she needs. Spreads her a shelter, take the tall skies, as they helter-skelter, along the same sides, and she waves my day. With a glad face, she fakes and says I'm a hard case. She makes ways like a bad ace, carrying my ways in the sky and space. But she knows me well. On the plains wings of the morning that I just could not face. Asking you these questions, telling you these lies, enveloping direction, developing disguise. Open to suggestion, but I'm closed to all my eyes. I'm dead on arrival, right where I stand. I'm dead on arrival, right where I stand. I'm dead on arrival, right where I stand. Just an ashtray, flesh is my best wheel. The atmosphere's my highway, and the landscape's my next meal. I need my own propriety, and I'm trying to fix the deal. I'm dead on arrival, right where I stand. I'm dead on arrival, right where I stand. She moves through the dawn fanfare. The dew leaves the bruise in the magic air. I feel a finger running through my nightmares now. Feel moves together with my nowhere stare. And you know me well. Me and my woman.
Clute, Nick Harper and the Strings. We'll see you.
It really doesn't get any better than that. I've just been listening to that while recording the podcast, and as usual, I've come out in goosebumps. I can't fault that song. It is wonderful, absolutely wonderful. And what a version of it. Now I'm going to do the credits and then we'll launch into the final bit, which is the feedback. Credits. This podcast is issued under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivative 2.0 UK, England and Wales license, which means basically you can share it with others freely, but you can't change it, claim you made it, or charge for it. The Roy Harper music in this podcast is used by kind permission of Science Friction Limited and is not for copying or redistribution. If you want to help the podcast, please give us a review on iTunes if you use iTunes. If you want to send in a voicemail, 01223 850 282, or if you're not in the UK, +441 223 850 282. I love receiving voicemails. Please send me an MP3 if you like, pd@stormcock.net or podcast@stormcock.net, and I'll play it on the next podcast. Okay, now I'm going to finish with some feedback. I took my microphone to the Cropperty Festival, and the Stormcock aficionados, people that are on the mailing list and frequent the forums and website, we all had a little meet up on the Saturday, a few lunchtime beers and a general chat, lots of fun. So here are the sound bites. Please be aware that there is some swearing in this section. If you've got children listening, you probably want to stop the podcast now. Play this final bit later on. That's all for now. I'll see you in a couple of weeks. I hope you enjoyed this one, and let's look forward to part three. Bye for now.
Fuck off!
Fuck off!
It's raining!
I'm recording.
And it's muddy backstage and it's horrible.
Fuck off!
That's right. Tony Pugh, what message do you have for
this? You've had my message. I'm going to be bogged down backstage for a week.
Right. Okay. Elle Rose, do you have a message?
Not that wouldn't get you X-rated.
I can see I'm not going to do very well with this, am I?
No,
it's Richard, in case you don't remember. Yeah,
well. Sorry. I'll just record a bit more for the general ambience, I think.
I still reckon the sun's coming out right now, gradually. It's right over there.
I admire your positive attitude, yeah, John.
Immediately before hell.
Your eyesight and grip on reality, alternatively, are not...
You are wrong, but... I admire you.
Well, there's nothing like blind optimism.
This
would be the straw that breaks the camel's back.
The plan was always to go home today.
Yeah.
I came up to have a shower. I was queuing up for breakfast in a bar. And I phoned Maggie to go, do you want an egg back? She went, no, I'm paranoid. I just phoned her to say goodbye. I was like, alright.
Came down on Tuesday.
That's brilliant.
All I need to know is what your name is and what your message is for the podcast.
Is that it?
Go on.
My name's James Hanley. My message for the podcast is hello to everyone from sunny Cropperty. It's really hot. It's beautiful. The sun's been out. I've got a bit of sunburn that all down my back. And I wish it would cool down and start raining.
I know. Damn this English weather. It's too good. Right, perfect. Thank you. Right, off you go.
Recording now?
Yeah.
Hi, this is Neil, a.k.a. Bob Toms. You know you love it. Come to Cropperty. You may see Roy one day. Do it.
We may see the sun one day as well. Would you like to say something?
Hi, this is Shirley, and this is my first time come here, and really, I will enjoy it.
Okay, and you'll
Thank
get
you.
Wet as well. Thank
yeah,
you very much, Shirley.
Under the brolly, okay. It'll be all right.
Oh, sorry.
You're right, man. Another one.
Right.
How you doing, Paul?
Fine, thanks. Who are you and what is your message for the podcast?
I'm Mike Bishop, and my message is that it's very, very sunny at Cropperty, and it's the best Cropperty ever. And everyone who's not here is really missing out on huge fun.
Brilliant, thank you. What's your name and what is your message for the podcast?
My name's Gordon Walker. My message for the podcast is tree beard for Cropperty. Yes. Not just the pub.
Not just for Christmas.
I'm very firm on okay. The fact that it should be at 12.
What is your name and what is your message for the
and
podcast?
For many years.
My name is Alice, and the message is.
Why not? I think I might actually post some places.
I think that about covers it.
That's good. That's good for a Saturday. Right.